Hybrid Books, Budapest's weekly English language cultural magazine.
Welcome to a very special episode of Liquid Books. We're joined in the studio with philosopher Laszlo Erwin. Erwin Laszlo, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Erwin, you have been a tremendous influence on many areas of thinking, particularly in terms of systems theory, regional and interregional cooperation, global consciousness, and the emerging paradigm of the world as a harmonious collaboration of cultures. And now you've come out with a new book called The Chaos Point, The World at the Crossroads. Can you tell us what is the purpose of this new book?
I think the key to our future is to be aware of the present. We are living in the present, but depending on what we do in the present, different futures will await us. So this is to call attention to the fact that we live in a very crucial time, at a time when we have a decision window where we can change major trends, sometimes called mega trends, so that the conditions that we are heading toward in this world will permit a positive future, a positive transformation. What we know about the present is that these trends going with these trends is a little bit like riding a bicycle. You cannot stop, you cannot go backward, you must go forward, but we also know that the road ahead is forking off. You cannot go forward exactly the way we have been doing up till now, because this is the quintessence of the term unsustainability. The world today that we have created over the past, I don't know, 20, 30, 50 years, is not sustainable. So ecologically, economically, socially, and culturally, we have to change. It's possible to change, and this book is to call attention to two things. One, that we need to change, and the second, that there are positive options to change so as to create a sustainable and peaceful future for all of us.
One thing which is extraordinary about this book is that it combines a great wealth of research in different areas coherently together. There is a lot of research into politics and the political models of the world, as well as the ecological model, the cultural model, and so on. One question I have for you: how has your experience at the United Nations formed this world outlook for you?
Well, I spent 7 years at the United Nations as Director of Research at the Institute for Training and Research of the United Nations, and I have come to realize two things. One, that individually people are very open. The Secretariat certainly is very open, but also the delegates and the ambassadors are very open to bring in new ideas and to recognizing the need to behave and to act, to have policies that could assure a sustainable world for all of us. The second thing that I recognize is that individual insight doesn't necessarily translate into institutional action. When people recognize that they need to do something, when they assume their official position and they have to act, for example, voting on recommendations, on proposals, or various kind of political proposals at the General Assembly, resolutions, I meant to say, then it turns out that they are voting as their representatives of their government, and therefore the institutional system is much more, has a much greater inertia than the individuals. So I decided that after 7 years at the United Nations, I want to deal more directly with individuals, more directly also with civil society, and hope that when there is a groundswell of change, which is coming, which is happening in society, then the institutions themselves will change.
When we look at the changing attitudes of people in societies, I know that one aspect of the research that you're helping to carry out today is in this notion of cultural creatives. Can you tell us a little bit about the state of affairs with cultural creatives?
You know, it would be entirely utopian and idealistic to believe that new trends are coming, that there is a major change, unless we saw that this is happening already. One cannot just create a major trend, although, you know, individuals can do a great deal. Margaret Mead, the famous anthropologist, was quite right when she said that never doubt the power of a small group of people to change the world, and she said nothing else ever has. But a small group can change the world when the world is ready to be changed. And today it's beginning to be ready. And we see that underneath the trends, underneath the politics, underneath the headlines, there is a concern, there is a will, there is a new consciousness and a new ethic which is arising. It hasn't reached the centers of power as yet. Nobody recognizes how powerful this movement actually is. It is much more powerful than people think. But it turns out that there is a new culture. If you do what a U.S. public opinion researcher by the name of Paul Ray has done, namely to divide the adult population of the Western world into three segments, then you have the moderns. The moderns are the Madison Avenue types, are the political leaders, are the business leaders. That is one segment. We know their values. We know that they want more and more wealth. They want power. They want to live well in a certain way that is typical of the Western world. The second is the traditionals. These are people in the small towns, mostly older people, who believe that they want to preserve traditional values. They are worried about the fast pace of change. They want to retire. They want to keep and conserve their own inherited values. And that group is also quite present and powerful. But the third group, which people didn't recognize that it is a powerful group until some surveys, which among others, the Club Budapest that I was responsible for, I am say responsible for, has been doing research on this culture of creatives. It turns out that almost one-fourth in the United States and one-third in some countries of Europe of the adult population belongs to the third group. The third group is sometimes called cultural creatives. It's the responsible culture. It's the culture of people who are concerned, people who believe that they can do something, people who at least want to start themselves by adopting a lifestyle that is less wasteful, that is more concerned with the environment and with relations to other people. So this is a very hopeful development. It's growing very rapidly, and we hope that as this new culture spreads, it will indeed bring about change toward a trend that will create a better world. Thank you.
You mentioned Club of Budapest, which I know is an organization which you started to manifest the values needed toward an emerging global consciousness. In other words, to reflect the need for a cultural component, for a spiritual component, as well as the traditional political, economic, and so on efforts at managing the world. I wonder if you have a particular model in mind for the world that you are working toward. In this book, Chaos Point, you speak of I believe the term you use is heterarchy, something like a federation on a global level. Is that a shared common vision that many people are moving toward in the world, and what is it exactly?
Well, let me speak on my personal capacity. I come from the sciences, and my particular area was systems theory, general systems, and general evolution theory. That means we are looking at large ensembles of factors, whether they are biological species or societies or ecologies, and see how they evolve, how they behave together. So it turns out that these trends of evolution move alternately toward differentiation and integration. That means when you have a set of entities with a lot of different species, let's say a lot of different people and cultures living together, they form a system. This system tends to differentiate. These different components become more and more, achieve their own identity. A good example is Europe, for example, where on the level, on the grassroots level, more and more groups want to achieve their own identity. Smaller regions increasingly looking for a same level of autonomy. But at the same time, as there is this differentiation, there is also integration. Integration on the level of the whole system. Again, Europe, an example. You see, all the different countries, 25 countries now, and there will be actually 55 countries if you look at the OECD list of what they call Europe, then these things, these countries are actually moving toward a level of integration. Worldwide, there is likewise a trend, much lower level of achievement as yet in terms of integration. But we see that the many, many countries of the world, some almost 190 members of the United Nations, I think there are 204 have been inscribed at the World Cup football championship. There are more countries inscribed there than there are in the United Nations. But all these groups, and with thousands of languages and ethnic groups, there is some commonality emerging because we are all living on this earth and we must manage ourselves together. And this must be expressed on the economic level, on the political level. Economic level, the key word is globalization. It's not a good way that is being pursued today because it's rather one-sided. There is finance, technology, and big business is the leading actors, and often people and cultures and ethnic groups are left out of it. However, globalization is a trend toward a global level of systems development. What we need on the level of the entire system is to globalize in a balanced way, to integrate without disregarding the autonomy, without disregarding identity. So with recognition for differences, with respect for individuality, but recognize and act the way we are, namely that we are members of a species that is now a planetary species. We are living on practically all the inhabitable parts of the globe. We are communicating through the internet, through radio and television, and through the cell phones, and all possible means are now coming up more and more, and we are linked together. And we have to create a level of integration, respectful, as I said, of differences, but a level of integration that enables us to create a positive, sustainable, and peaceful future for all of us.
One compelling and extraordinary part of your research was presented in a recent book called The Akashic Field, an integrated theory of everything. You have done an incredible amount of work in the philosophy of science, and this Akashic Field is the fruit of many years of study of different fields of science and their strangenesses, and presents a theory which accounts for, in a quite an elegant way, something which could very well be the dominant philosophy of the next century in science. Could you briefly outline that and explain how it relates to what we're talking about today?
You know, science itself doesn't grow by little steps. People think that what scientists do is just keep observing, and they codify their observations and add fact to fact, and it gradually grows by accumulation, by accretion, as it were. It's not true. Now, in the philosophy of science, and scientists themselves know that science grows by leaps and bounds. There is a certain, what is known as a paradigm, a way of thinking, way of visualizing, conceptualizing the world. And that's explored until you get more and more problems, more and more so-called anomalies. That means facts, findings that do not fit your conceptions. Then a change. Sooner or later, a change happens. It happened when we switched to Newtonian physics, to Einsteinian physics, from there to quantum physics, in biology from the standard mechanistic, teleological kind of 19th century biology to the modern biology, which now moving into a systems and even into a level of a quantum biology. It happens in all fields, actually. So now we are moving in toward a new paradigm. This new paradigm is keynoted by the fact that things are coherent. That means, by coherence in science, it simply means that what happens in one part of a system also affects the other parts and affects it practically instantly. So that we could say that what happens in one place at one time also affects other places and other times. This is a kind of coherence, which means correlation, which means co-development, and it needs something that coheres, that correlates, that creates the connection. This something in science is simply called a field. We recognize that there is a field like this. Sometimes it's called the quantum vacuum. It's a misleading term because vacuum is not, it says empty space, and this is not empty. This is full of virtual, very subtle energies. And this vacuum, I claim, and I've shown this in my work, conserves and transmits not only energy, but also a subtle kind of an energy which we can call information. Information with a hyphen. And this means that this field acts as a memory, because everything that happens is conserved in it. Information, the past informs the present, and the present continues to inform the future. Why is it called Akasha field or Akashic field? Because I recognize later on in my research, after I have developed these theories, that the way this field functions is almost exactly like the ancient Hindu philosophers and seers have thought it does, and they called it Akasha. They talked about the five major elements, you know, and of the five major elements, they said the most important one is Akasha, which was also called the ether or the brilliance, something that underlies all other things. And we now recognize in the new physics, the new cosmological physics, what underlies the known phenomena in the world is a field from which the particles emerge in the Big Bang, but even emerge since then when you insert sufficient level of energy. And these particles form systems, and the systems that formed by the particles remain bound, remain connected by this underlying field, which is called, sometimes called the unified vacuum or called the new ether. So Akasha, 5,000 years ago, re-emerges today in the form of a quantum unified vacuum.
Does the understanding of, in so elegant and coherent a way, the existence of what I take to be a coexisting plane of existence, which is non-material, does this provide a great new mechanism for moving forward as well, culturally, socially, politically, and so on? So are these two sides of the same phenomenon?
I think it provides a tremendous impetus. One basic problem with people today is that they feel isolated, they feel separate. Sometimes it's lonely, sometimes it's just the sense of tooth for tooth and eye for an eye, and everybody is just out to fight for himself. And this kind of separateness is an illusion, actually. It's what the Eastern philosophers would call the Maya, a kind of a cosmic illusion, because underneath it all, we are actually connected. The great psychologist William James said it very well. He said, we are like islands in the sea. We are separate on the surface, but connected in the depths. Now, this depth has been disregarded in the Western culture in the past 200, 250 years. It has not been disregarded in traditional cultures, and it is not disregarded in the new trends when people recognize, again, their connection to each other and to nature, that we are part of the biosphere, and the biosphere is part of the cosmos. The problem was credibility. As long as science could not tell us that there is a field like that, that this sense of connectedness that people have when they are meditate, when they are religious, when they enter a deeper state of consciousness, or when they are simply sensitive individuals, that this is not purely an illusion. This is something that is true, that is actually a fact, can be explained in terms of the new physics and the new biology and the new ecology. So the recognition that this is a real connection that we have with each other and to nature, that is an important element in creating solidarity. And solidarity, because we know that we are one, ultimately we are one. And solidarity, of course, a very major factor of creating the kind of world that is worthy of us and worthy of our children.
Yeah.
presumably one of the great narratives of our time that illustrates this coming together of consciousness at a global level would be the environmental movement. Do you see, over the course of your research, other such signs that we are moving in that direction on a global level?
Well, the cultural recognition, the cultural surveys that we are doing nowadays in various countries in Europe, in the United States, in the Far East as well, show that there is a movement of this kind. In business world, you see the move toward corporate social responsibility, CSR, is a recognition of that. It's not often very strongly developed, and it's not very deep, because sometimes businesses use it only as a marketing tool. But more and more business leaders recognize that social responsibility on their part, which includes ecological responsibility as well, that it is not only a good way to sell their products, but it's actually a key to success in the long term. And besides, it's an ethical imperative. If you want to feel good about what you're doing, you have to behave more responsibly. There it is there. I think it emerges in civil society, on the social, cultural level. It emerges in business. In politics, it's much slower, because in politics, you require new political leaders to be elected, and they will be elected, can be elected. They are around, but they can be elected to important office only when there is a critical mass of the electorates who are willing to recognize that they need politicians, they need leaders of this kind. This is happening. I hope it will be happening in the next elections in the United States. It is gradually happening in various parts of the world. And altogether, the trend is hopeful. But the real drivers of the trend are in civil society, and they're young people and women more than anybody else, and on a certain level, big business leaders and young people who are entering the business world.
Can you give our listeners any advice how not to fall into the trap of despair or panic about the narrative of terrorism?
Well, terrorism is not the cause of the problems. Terrorism is a symptom, it's a result. You can't overcome terrorism by killing terrorists. It is very much the same as you saying that, which people often try, of course, like trying to overcome cancer by just simply deadening the cancerous cells. If the body itself is sick, there'll be more cells will become cancerous. Because cancer is a kind of a breakdown of communication between the cells. So the cells just keep multiplying themselves with regard to the rest. What happens in terrorism also? You know, it is a symptom because it's born because society on that level, in that aspect, is sick, is full of resentment, is full of hate, and people want to act, do something to right wrongs. Now, whether they are perceived wrongs or real wrongs, it's usually it's both. But these wrongs have to be righted before we can expect that people stop turning to terrorism as a tool. And by simply countering terrorism is more violence, organized violence, which we call warfare. That is a very short-term solution. Actually, it irritates the whole system and it creates more terror in the longer term, or more insecurity of various kinds. So my suggestion, and based on systems theory, based on my reading of the trends, is instead of countering an eye for an eye with a tooth for a tooth, hand, to stretch out the hand, start the dialogue, start discussing, and find out what's wrong. Find out why people have this hate. If we can begin a dialogue, a multilogue, actually, across cultures, I think gradually we can find the common elements, we can find those values and interests that unite us rather than divide us.
Thank you for that. You founded an organization called Club of Budapest. How can our listeners get involved with club activities and what is the club doing these days?
Well, I suggest first of all they look it up on the web. It's www.clubofbudapest, clubofbudapestinoneword.org. That's an English language website. There are many languages now. The German, for example, is DE, the French is FR, the Italian is IT, etc. at the end. The Hungarian is HU. So people can understand, can read up a little bit what is happening there. We're also doing reports, we're giving prizes. We are organizing surveys, and we are having various projects, including a very major project oriented to 2012, the year 2012, which is the famous Mayan prophecy for a major change in the world, which probably is heralds actually a turning point in human affairs, not because the Mayans thought so, but because many of the trends that we have today become unsustainable and become irreversible in the next 6 or 7 years. So we are a group of people who are willing to pull together, who are organizing national organizations, national forums, where like-minded people can come together, can suggest their own ideas, have a voice. We are now creating also an internet-based channel, which we call the ACT, the Change the World channel, where people will be able to upload their own videos, bring their own voice also to be heard. This is not running yet. This will run toward the end of 2006. However, these are the kind of activities we are doing. We are present now in 15 different countries, including in England, many countries in Europe, in the United States, Canada, Japan, China, India, even in small countries like Nepal and Samoa. So I would invite people who listen to this program to look it up on the web and contact us and see if they wish to join. We welcome all like-minded people.
And by like-minded, it really encompasses quite a range of people. So people who are working in their own professions, be it sociology, be it some aspect of the arts, be it economics and so on, all can find a place in the club. It brings to mind a quote from Bakhtin. He refers to the co-creativity of those who understand. And the club really functions in that manner wonderfully as a point of light in the world. And thank you for coming in, Dr. Lasso, and sharing these thoughts with us today. I hope you will come back and join us again sometime.
Well, thank you, Andrew Singer. I enjoyed our little conversation.
Thank you to our engineer, Naji, and from all of us here at Liquid Books. Good night.